Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Friday, September 17, 2021. It's a rainy morning here in Nashville and promising to be a rainy weekend. I was hoping to clear some weeds out in the garden, which have accumulated while we've been traveling, and we'll have to see if that ever gets done. As always, thank you to Ron Trammell and the Cats Tribute Band for our bluesy intro music. Some weeks ago, local news media here in Nashville and regionally reported about serious flooding in Waverly, Humphreys County, Tennessee. Flooding there this summer has caused serious loss of life and significant property damage in that rural county. I've been to Waverly many times over the years. It is a community that struggles even in the best of times. The square has a modern brutalist-style courthouse surrounded by many abandoned storefronts. And so events like this truly make hard times even worse. But hearing this news, it was impossible for me not to think of my old friend Alan Coggins, who authored a book entitled Tennessee Tragedies and published by the UT Press. It came out in 2011. It occurred to me that it would be fun to talk to Alan about not only his book, but also about his previous career in parks and conservation, and later in emergency management. Alan was truly on the ground floor in parks in Tennessee as a park naturalist, one of the first administrators of the state Natural Areas Program, and as a park planner, responsible for the first master plan for Radnor Lake and several other important Tennessee parks. As you will hear, he later served with the Tennessee Emergency Management Agency and with the Joint Universities Agency as an emergency planner. Those of you who share an interest in Tennessee history will want to check out his impressive book. And so, on with the show. I hope you'll enjoy this interview with Alan Coggins. Alan Coggins, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. You know, you look a lot older than you used to.
You know, Alan, and I have less hair. I know you noticed that.
But otherwise, you look pretty good, guy.
Well, thank you. I have, you know, with aging in my family comes hair loss. So there's, you know, they say that that genetics is everything and you can't escape it. So there you go.
Well, they also say that God made two kinds of heads, the ones he liked, the ones he didn't like, he covered up.
There you go. Hadn't heard that one before. So, Alan, it's really going to be fun to talk with you today. You know, I can remember first meeting you when I went to work at Conservation in 1979. And so you and I have some history together. And what we do in this program is we talk to people that have been involved or are involved in conservation, parks and recreation and related fields. And we talk to them about the history of their careers and get from them, if we can, observations about what's going on in parks and recreation and conservation. And we learn from their stories. And that's what we're all about here today. Alan, I know you were trained in field biology. Where did you go to school?
I went to Middle Tennessee State University.
I see. And do you have recollections of who your professors there or anybody that was an influence to you there?
Well, they're all dead now, but I do remember certain professors like entomology. I worked for a professor there. He was an arachnid toxicologist, and he raised venomous spiders, black widows and ground recluses. And I was in charge of separating those eggs and things like that. So I got a early touch with those critters, and it was a very rounded career. And curriculum, rather. So I really got involved in field biology and in interpretation.
Really cool. Now, where did you grow up, Alan?
I grew up in Oak Ridge.
Okay, I thought that I remembered that. You know, we had a whole contingent of Oak Ridge and Norris folks that worked in conservation back in the day. Tell us about your growing up and maybe what got you interested in field biology.
Well, I liked to hike. I liked to spelunk. I liked to go caving all the time, and I spent a lot of time doing that. And just most of my life was outside. Couldn't find a lot of things inside that interest me. And we didn't have the internet back then, so I couldn't explore very widely except through books. But I tried to pick that knowledge up in the field.
Very good. Now, you sent me kind of a resume of sorts in the mail in preparation for this recording, and I noticed, and these were facts that I didn't know about you until then. I noticed that you got started as a seasonal interpretive specialist over at Big Ridge. Tell us about your experience there.
Yes, I went to Big Ridge. I worked under a superintendent by the name of Jim Robb, the late Jim
Oh
Robb.
my.
He was really the epitome of what I thought a park naturalist or a park superintendent would be, and he taught me a lot. I worked there for one summer, and then I left and decided that I was going to go back to graduate school at UT. So I did so, but I ran out of money. I was building up college debt, which I knew was going to be incredible by the time I finished, so I dropped out. And that next summer, I went over to work at Norris Dam State Park. And kind of after that summer, then there was nothing out there yet, but I was told that the West Tennessee District Naturalist Joe Gaines had to fulfill a short military service, and I was asked if I would take over his position for a few months with the understanding that when he came back, I would give him the job back. And so I did so.
So you have had experiences then in all three grand divisions of Tennessee then.
Yes.
So you, let me jump back just for a second. You mentioned Jim Robb and I remember Jim a little bit. I didn't know him well, but when I first met him, he was at Old Stone Fort in Manchester.
Right, that was his second park.
But he Well, you as you described it, he was the epitome of the park ranger, park superintendent, extraordinarily knowledgeable about nature and particularly birds, as I recall, and a handlebar mustache and really terrific, terrific, terrific guy, well regarded by all that ever interacted with him for sure.
Yeah, he liked to talk to scout groups, and he would go out and he would talk to them about the frontier and about what the first settlers, pioneers, went through. And I sent him. I was out west, and I sent him a couple of presents. One was a buffalo patty, and
Oh.
the other one, of course, they say he used all part of the buffalo. They use the buffalo patties to burn
Of course.
to warm their food and stuff. And I also sent him a tumbleweed. And he was just so excited about seeing both of those that he incorporated those into his scout meetings.
I love that. So you eventually, Alan, came to work in central office in Nashville and had several, really important roles to play there in central office. Talk about that.
Well, let me go back just a moment to the fact that summer, with no other options, I moved to Atlanta
Oh, that's right. You had a
for the big
stint in
spring.
Georgia. That's exactly
Yeah.
right.
And I walked in off the street to Georgia State Parks, and I filled out an application. And I was taken back into human resources and talked to a lady, and she said, well, you look like you have good qualifications. She said, how did you know about the new position? And I said, what new position? He said the federal money we're applying for to get a state naturalist. And I said, well, I didn't know about it. She said, well, you seem to be pretty qualified. So she hired me at that point as acting superintendent of Panola Mountain State Park in Atlanta. And that's relatively undisturbed natural area like Iradnor Lake in Nashville. I worked there for a while and later was transferred to a new park, Watson Mill Bridge State Park, about 100 miles east of Atlanta. And that park was under development. And eventually the federal money came through and I became Georgia's first chief park naturalist. That summer, I hired a seasonal naturalist staff and this program started off.
That's exciting to be on the ground floor of something like that.
Yeah.
Tell us more details about the numbers of people involved and the kinds of programs that were presented.
Well, we had park seasonal naturalists ranging from 18 to, I think the guy was 87 years old.
He
was
a local professor.
And so we kind of got together and talked about how we would go about interpreting our park, looking at the various aspects of the park and trying to talk to them about the fact that we need to know the who, what, when, where, why, and how of your park. And then you need to develop programs around those things. If you're in a historic park, if you're in a natural park, then you need to draw on what's there.
Very good, very good. And for how long did you work in Georgia?
I worked for about 3 years, and then I got word that the chief naturalist position with Tennessee was available. And I applied for it, and with the help of three naturalist friends, I got the job.
Super.
You may recall them, district naturalist. There was Frank Luther. It was in Middle Tennessee. He later went back to dental school and became a very successful dentist in Middle Tennessee. And Richard Hilton was East Tennessee district naturalist. And he left and joined the Harley-Davidson Company, where he quickly rose in the ranks. Marilyn Williamson was a West Tennessee district naturalist. She moved to Georgia, got married, and I've never heard from her since.
Right. I don't know where she is. Haven't heard from her.
Yeah, she just kind of disappeared south.
Well, she was one of the very first female rangers in Tennessee State Parks history.
Yeah, and she was the first female naturalist. I don't know about
She later qualified, went to the, it's my recollection that she went to the law enforcement training situation and actually got commissioned as a ranger.
Oh, okay.
In those days, you say a chief naturalist, so we had a naturalist in each of the grand divisions and a chief in central office kind of supervising their activities.
Yes, and we had an exhibits crew in Middle Tennessee, too, that built all the dioramas and the exhibits to set our museums up.
Right, and a sort of parallel to that, there was the recreation staff with Charlie Tate and his bunch.
Yeah, they were equivalent to the naturalist as far as working in the three districts.
Right, and so each of those, for example, the one in East Tennessee would do naturalist programs in the East Tennessee and in the East Tennessee parks, cover a lot of area there.
Yeah, and the district recreation had the counterparts to naturalist recreators that worked in individual parks.
So, do you have any good recollections of those times and circumstances?
Well, yeah, we got along pretty well, and I don't recall that we really tried to fuse those two disciplines together in any particular park. But they worked amiably with each other, and did a lot for recreation, just like the naturalists did a lot for natural science.
So the director, when you were hired in that position, was Jack Miller, I presume?
Yeah. No. We'll go back one. Bill Boswell.
Oh, no kidding. Okay. Got you. So that's earlier than I was thinking.
Right.
Right. And then, of course, Boswell had been director and stepped out of the department for a brief while and then came back as the chief ranger for many years.
Yeah.
Person that I regarded a great deal.
Oh, absolutely. Me too.
Terrific guy. Well, then am I correct that you moved over into the Division of Planning and Development?
Well, yeah, I was from 1974 to 1984, I was the chief naturalist,
Okay.
and then I became the state natural areas administrator. Then I moved over to conservation, and I was a natural and cultural resource manager, and finally a department master manager,
Okay.
master planner rather. And
Okay.
during those three positions, I had the pleasure of helping develop master plans for Radnor Lake in Nashville, Big Cypress Tree, Dunbar Cave, Big Bone Cave in Middle Tennessee, Frozen Head in East Tennessee, and of course the South Cumberland Recreation Area.
Back in those days, there was kind of a template for what a park master plan was. I guess maybe you developed that template.
Yes, I did. Well, I took up the development of it after it had been worked on for a few years.
Right. Tell
And
us more about that. I remember Spencer Boardman was involved in coming up with the concept of the Tennessee Outdoor Recreation Area System
yeah, we called it TORAS.
and the plan for that. And each of the parks had its own plan depending on its classification in
Right.
that system.
Yeah, I took his job when he left.
I
And
see.
the idea was that instead of trying to provide all things for all things and all things for all people in each park, that we would develop a series of parks that and recreation areas concentrating on one particular thing. There were natural areas, the state parks that we think of, like Big Ridge, Standing Stone, the ones that are primitive. There were state recreation sites, which were usually closer to urban areas. There were state natural areas. I may have mentioned that already, sorry. Historic sites, archaeological sites, and of course, the big super parks like Fall Creek Falls,
Right, the
which,
resort park
resort
concept.
park. And it was
Right.
also a natural area because of the big land mass that it had
Sure,
around it.
exactly. I want to step back just a second and talk about Radnor. And you gave that as one of the parks that you were involved in the writing of the master plan.
Right.
And I think when I first met you is when you were actually doing that. That park, tell us about your observations of that park. Rather than me leading you into a different concept, let me ask you, just tell us your recollections of the first time you got on that land and what you saw and what maybe you envisioned for that park.
Well, it was very unique in that it was within an urban area. It had been preserved by family and then later by a caretaker. It was originally developed as a source of water for the steam engines down in railroad yards in Nashville. And because it was a natural, it was an artificial lake, but because it became natural, it became kind of a hunting reserve and a fishing reserve for those people who were in high positions with the railroad. But because it continued to be relatively wild, it was absolutely perfect as an urban, not wilderness area. In Knoxville, we talk about the urban wilderness areas. Actually, there were urban wildland areas, I think. But Radnor took on a life of its own, began to be treated as if it were really a virgin piece of property that nobody had ever touched and stuff like that. But people loved it. A lot of people visited it, and a lot of effort went into studying the park and to making sure that we were able to preserve it in spite of the large numbers of people that were coming there. And we had rules that were unique to that park, like there was no fishing, no hunting, no gathering, nothing like that. It was just a place to go and run or walk and just enjoy nature.
I can remember, Alan, the development of the trails system in that park and the conversations that were had about where those trails were going to be, how close to the lake they were going to be or not be, the materials, the surface trotting material that was going to be used for the paths. Do you remember those conversations?
Yeah, we wanted, first of all, to protect that lake. We didn't want people kind of tromping along the edge of the lake all the way around, you know, like fishermen would do. But rather, we wanted to approach, have a trail that went through the woods, approached the lake, perhaps provided two or three stopping points where you could actually stand and look at the lake. And then our trails were guided toward other features that people might be interested in.
Right. You know, there's been a tradition over the last many years at Radnor where they recycle used Christmas trees.
Right.
Chipped up, and they use those on the for the surface of the trails as a means of preventing erosion and that sort of thing.
Right. A lot of parks have started doing that. They've been doing it for years. I know here at Iams Nature Center in Knoxville, they have a yearly drive to have people come by and drop their Christmas trees, and then they will chip them up and use them on the trails.
You know, and if they were to let nature take its course with the numbers of visitors that they have out there at Radnor, those trails would become terribly eroded and not much to walk on.
Yeah, kind of like the Appalachian Trail. Some places it's 4 and 5 feet deep.
Yes, exactly. You know, in those times, Alan, I remember being in that park and being overwhelmed. And I remember that your early plan talked about the issue of invasive exotic plants that were prevalent at that time in Radnor Lake. What
right.
do you recall about that?
Well, I recall that later efforts were to try to physically remove those plants. Nothing was planted except things that might have been there in the beginning. And we just wanted to get rid of those exotics and try to turn it back into the environment that it had been even prior to the railroad taking over the property and putting a lake in there.
Right. Well, I'm just curious, when was the last time you had the opportunity to visit Radnor?
Oh, gosh, it's been about 6 or 7 years ago. I noticed at that point that Walt Crowley, who had been the director of conservation planning, it was named for him. And I was very pleased. And Walt was a very close friend, and we worked together very, very well. And it just kind of made me choke up a little bit when I looked up and saw that picture of him and the sign that said the park was dedicated to Walt Crowley.
Well, your observation is exactly correct. The visitor center there is named in his honor.
Right.
And you and I had the honor of working for Walter, who, as you say, was a good friend and somebody that everyone admired, died too young.
Yes, he did. You know, it was odd. He was the kind of person who had papers piled up everywhere. I mean, all over his office. He was almost sitting behind a shell of papers and on his credenza and all around the walls. But if you walked in there and you asked him for something, he would go over to the particular pile, go two-thirds of the way down, and pull out the piece of paper that you wanted. He was that kind of guy.
Well, I remember that well. Walter had his fingers in a lot of pies. Not only was he shepherding the development of plans like you were doing for him there at Radnor Lake, but he was instrumental in the creation of Fall Creek and some of the wondrous developments that we have in our state parks.
Yes.
So, Alan, you know, I know that you later left the state park system and went on to work at the Tennessee Emergency Management Agency. And in fact, I thought about calling you and doing this interview because of the recent emergency situation that's happened in Waverly, Tennessee, with the flooding there here in the last few weeks. It brought to mind your book and that we want to talk about a little bit. But tell us about beginning to work with the Tennessee Emergency Management Agency.
Well, I kind of got tired of politics and conservation. And after three administrations, I got fed up, particularly since the last one wanted to do away with the Tennessee Outdoor Recreation Area system. They said that was something that was created by earlier governors and that they wanted something new. And that was the last straw because we had worked so hard with so many organizations, trails people, rivers people, the Sierra Club, just, you know, so many groups in trying to put that plan together, which would be unique in the United States. So I just decided I was through with it. And I had a friend that mentioned that there was a team that was looking for the Tennessee Outdoor, Tennessee Emergency Management Agency was looking for a natural hazards planner. And I wasn't exactly sure what that was, but I went over and we started talking and I found out that I would be working with the Tennessee State Emergency Management Plan, that I would actually rewrite the thing. And I would be a technical writer. And when I joined them, the first task I was asked to do was to write an introduction to the plan. And it was to include some of Tennessee's historic disasters. So after poring over numerous TEMA documents and spending a lot of time in the state libraries and archives, I concluded that no one had ever chronicled state disasters. There was data out there, old newspapers, books, and miscellaneous documents, but there was no timeline, and I wanted it to be in chronological order. So that led me actually to a 20-year quest to write a book entitled Tennessee Tragedies, Natural, Cultural, and Societal Disasters in the Volunteer State. That was not my title that I suggested. It was that by the University of Tennessee Press editors. So we kind of went with that. Oh, yeah, there's the book.
I'm holding it up to share okay. it with Alan.
You know, well, few years after that, a colleague of mine told me that ORAU, Oak Ridge Associated Universities, was looking for a person that would work on the local state and federal level in emergency management. And so I thought, well, you know, that sounds good. He gave me a piece of paper, just a small piece of paper, which was an ad for the job. And he said, I'm trying for this job. Everybody in the department is trying for this job. Why don't you? So I said, okay. And I did. I wasn't expecting anything, but I happen to have a friend over there whose name was Ava Jean Moore. And she had worked in emergency management for years on the local level. She worked for TEMA for a while, and then she went with ORAU. And when I interviewed, they told me that I had just the right balance of local, state, and federal response and planning experience that they needed. So I got the job.
So this was a job with the Oak Ridge National Laboratory?
No, Oak Ridge Associated Universities.
Oh, I got it.
Yeah, they're an organization that works with Department of Energy, Department of Defense, FEMA, and many other federal agencies. I even had an opportunity to work with NASA when I was with that department.
And your responsibilities there were to coordinate among those agencies for disaster planning?
Yeah.
Emergency planning?
Yeah, writing the emergency management plan. And for the each time we had a disaster, we had to go back and redo the emergency management plan. So that was part of the job, too, was to go in and do the hazard assessments and to determine what went wrong and what we could do to keep this from happening in the future.
So, Alan, your book was published in 2011, if I'm correct on that. It is a gorgeous book and well done and just well laid out, and it chronicles, you know, train wrecks and natural disasters and weather related incidents of drought and numerous kinds of tragedies that have happened in Tennessee.
Right. Mass lynchings and just, you know, you name it. Let me tell you about one incident. Now, not all disasters, not all tragedies rise to the level of disaster, but there was a situation in Townsend back in the late 1800s where a lady was washing her clothes in the stream there, probably a little river. And she had three children that were five, 6 and 7 year olds. And she had a baby, and the baby was laying on a blanket next to the water there. And she sent her kids out to gather eggs. Of course, kids always kept up with the chickens and they knew where the eggs were. So they went out and they started looking for them, and they didn't come back for a while. And she got worried about them. She went to look for them, and she found that they had wandered into a nest of snakes, rattlesnakes, copperheads, whatever, and been fatally bitten.
Oh my.
She went back to pick up her baby, and the baby had crawled into the stream and drowned.
Oh my goodness.
So those are the terrible things that have happened that affect only, you know, one family and friends and such. It's not like the mine disasters that like happened up in Briceville back in the early 1900s, where you had a city called Fraterville, where a disaster occurred in the mine that killed all the men, just about all but three of the men living in that
that whole town.
Most women lost brothers and fathers and husbands and cousins, and at some point they realized there were about 1,000 young people that were left orphaned. And back then, we didn't have a TEMA. We didn't have a safety net for people that were in that kind of situation. So it was the churches, it was the local community that worked together to help these people to get the things they needed to continue to live.
Fascinating. Now, you know, I mentioned that my thought to call you to have our conversation today, came from listening to the reports of the recent flooding in Waverly. But Waverly is not has had tragedy before.
Yes, the big explosion there, a propane tank, I think it was on one of the rail cars. It killed a number of people. It injured a lot of people, and it caused a lot of property damage. In fact, two of the FEMA people that were there before I worked for FEMA, TEMA. One was killed outright. The other one was scarred. He was burned all over his body, but he continued to work. And he was able to survive it. But that was a really bad disaster.
1978, I believe, which would have put it squarely in the last part of the Blanton administration.
Yeah.
But your description of it in the book is so interesting. Apparently, there was a train derailment.
Yeah,
derailment. At first, there were tank cars filled with this natural gas of some propane or natural gas of some sort, heavier than plain air.
Yeah,
began to leak, and before they know it, it was ignited and I guess engulfed two or three city blocks of downtown Waverly.
It flowed along the ground, kind of like water would, until it found an ignition source, and then the whole thing blew.
Right. And I can remember going to Waverly the year after that or so. We were allocated some special funds to help them rebuild their city park there in Waverly.
Yeah.
You know, this is a community that doesn't have a lot to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and when they get hit with a punch like this, it really knocks the wind out of them.
Right.
So Alan, have you had some success with this book?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do not know his name. I'm sorry, I cannot remember it. But the present director of TEMA bought enough copies. Well, he bought, I guess, over 200, 300 copies, which he sent out to the various counties, county emergency management agency and city emergency management agencies around the state. And we anticipated that it would sell better than it did, but it just was, I don't think it was promoted enough. And I was told, actually, I did the research and I was told by somebody else, it was the only, Tennessee was the only state that ever wrote a comprehensive document on the disasters that it had suffered through the years. And there were the information about individual disasters like the Johnstown flood, things like that. But I actually covered every one of them that I could find. And, you know, the major ones made news. And I was able to pick those up.
Extraordinarily interesting book. Now, you know, this morning, in preparation for our talking, I went on the internet and entered the name of the book, and it appeared on Amazon. So I presume that it's still available if people wanted to purchase it.
Amazon and Noble, it's on several, you know, and just actually going to that name, Tennessee Tragedies, and you can find the book and my name and the other books that I've written.
The University of Tennessee Press, do they still have it in print or?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So you could go on their site probably as well.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. And so what are the other books that you've written?
Well, first one was on Place Names of the Smokies, which was written through the Great Smoky Mountains Association. And it talks about all the hills, the valleys, the streams, the trails, other natural features in the Great Smoky Mountains and tells how they got their name. Good example is Elkmont. Some people may think that it was named for the animal, but actually it was named for the fact that the Knoxville Elks Club used to have big picnics up there in the summer at a place called Elkmont Mountain, which was later shortened to Elkmont. And so that was a very successful book. It's out of print now. You can still get it online, get the cheap version. Don't buy this $250 version that you can find on some sites. But I also wrote a book. I decided that if I was going to be really consider myself a writer, I had to write a fiction book. So I did. I wrote a fiction book on Big Bone Cave over in Middle Tennessee, a fictitious prisoner of war camp where they made saltpeter, potassium nitrate, to produce gunpowder for the South because there was no importing gunpowder from anywhere else. They had to make their own. Fortunately, we had caves in Alabama, Tennessee, Virginia, Kentucky, that we could draw the saltpeter from to make that. And these three characters are working in this cave, and they managed to find a third entrance, which nobody else knows about. But when they get out, they think, well, where are we going? We don't know this area. So they buddied up with this third guy who knew the area, had family, and could get them out. So they start their journey to the north to try to get into Kentucky.
So interesting. And this sort of combines your interest in writing and with your earlier experiences at spelunking.
Yeah. And the history,
exactly,
everything
exactly.
In the book is, you know, all the places, the things, the names. I got most of those out of cemetery gravestones. But if you live in that area, everything sounds familiar to you. The only thing that's different is that it was a fictitious prisoner of war camp. It was mined as a saltpeter source, but not
sure.
by prisoners.
Sure, it was. You know, I can remember now. Big Bone Cave, it's if I'm not confusing it, is down near McMinnville.
Yeah.
South McMinnville. You know, during my tenure as state parks director, we had to close that cave to visitors because they discovered that it was very high in radon.
Yeah, well, most caves are, but in this case, I think they kind of wanted an excuse to close it because it was operated out of Rock Island, and they really did not have the resources to man that site. And so they just gated the cave and kind of closed the area down.
Yeah, I think it's available now for tours on a scheduled basis. But I can remember the closure, and, you know, there was kind of a public scare going on about radon, and the newspapers pick up the story, not so much of the closing of the cave, but of the radon.
Right.
I had several radio interviews with journalists seeking to find out more about that and to use that story in promotional ways. So.
It wasn't a danger to the public. If you went in, you know, once a year or once in a lifetime, there was no problem with the radon.
It was like getting a chest x-ray or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. But if you were a guide, then you would be in there a lot more time and sure. you could pick up the radon. So sure. It was a matter of either staggering the staff that would take people into the cave, or just kind of, like I said, they needed an excuse to kind of close it down altogether because it was just too much of a resource to have to manage.
So, Alan, as a person, and I'm, if you weren't the first director or chief of the Natural Areas Program in Tennessee, you were among the first. What are your observations about how that's developed and where it is today?
Well, Mac Pritchard was the first director, and he's a name that is known by many, many people in Tennessee. He was just an incredible man who devoted his life to discovering and protecting our natural resources. And Mac died a few years ago,
right.
And we really miss the guy. And yet he made such an impression on the conservation world, and he trained so many of us. He was so good at doing talks and taking hikes and stuff like that. There's a lot of interesting stories about Mac. One of them was, I remember the first trail hike I went on with him, a guided hike. He was walking along there, and there was a newspaper over on the side of the trail. And Mac went over there, and he picked it up, and he smelled it, and he said, "Pass this back." Says, "Fox urinated on it last night."
Oh, gee.
He never knew for sure whether he knew what he was talking about, or he was just trying to make it a more interesting program. But he was quite a character. I came in as the third. I don't know much about the second chief naturalist. I know that through the years, the program has really, really expanded, and they've done some wonderful work. I haven't paid close attention to them since my professional interest and stuff kind of led away from conservation
right.
and into emergency management, into, you know, being an author of books and things like that.
Right. Well, I encourage you to reach back and talk to some of the folks that would be glad to hear from you. I interviewed Reggie Reeves here in the last month or so ago, and he may be a fellow that you remember from Longhunter State Park.
Absolutely.
But the Natural Areas Program has greatly expanded, and you know, I think it's serving the state well. Trying to get their arms wrapped around all these little special places that we have, and I don't necessarily have the imagination to understand all the time that there are these special places, but they certainly are there.
Yeah, a lot of people have devoted a lot of time to trying to discover these areas, to try to determine the fauna and the flora that's there, and to protect those endangered species.
Yeah, you know, thankfully there's people that are smarter than I am.
Me too.
That can understand these things. For example, the Cedar Glades, was something I learned about, 79 or 80. Never had any concept that there was such a thing as a Cedar Glade.
Yep.
Or they're the special plants that grow there, but certainly that is a thing, and there are all kinds of special communities like that. Thinking about May Prairie, for example, is a remnant prairie, but there are numerous places around Tennessee that have some element of specialty to them, where plants and animals that are unique to those places are. Not always apparent by just walking by. You have to have some insight to see what you're looking at, or to understand what you're looking at.
Dr. Elsie Quarterman was at Vanderbilt, and she did a lot of the early work on Tennessee coneflower and some of the other endemics and endangered species. In fact, I think I remember someone saying that Elsie used to go in the fall and harvest the seeds from the coneflower and just walk at random throughout the area and drop those seeds. And now we have a lot of coneflowers there that otherwise we wouldn't have. And the original population may have perished.
You know, I'd never heard that story, but I do recall when Dr. Paul Summers was the botanist for the Heritage Division,
Right.
and you know, there was discussion, scientific type discussion, as to whether that coneflower or Echinacea was actually a separate species, or whether it was just a dwarf of the main species of Echinacea that we see, the pink coneflower that grows in gardens.
Right. Yeah, it was the Echinacea tennesseensis. It had
That's
its own
right. And they
different
were able to
name.
determine through DNA evaluation that it was actually a separate species, and it got its own name. So, well, Alan, it's been a joy to spend some time with you today. It's so much fun. I hope that you, when you visit Nashville sometime, you'll come by and say hello and autograph that book
I
that I
certainly
bought
will.
10 years ago or so.
Maybe we can go to Radnor together.
You know, that would be really fun,
Yeah.
to walk around that park together. I think you'd be amazed at the progress that they've made in removing the invasive exotics there. It's a testament to really hard work on the part of the staff there.
The Senate, the volunteers and the Tennessee citizen scientists have done incredible things
Exactly.
in our state.
Alan, it's been a joy to speak with you, and I thank you very much for being my guest today.
Great, Mark. It's nice seeing you again and talking to you again, and look forward to meeting you in Nashville.
Very good.